listeners, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and it's almost Valentine's Day. Love is in the air. We're thinking romance, a man, a woman, a gift box of chocolates. Wait, hold on. I momentarily forgot we're all on our post-holiday diet and shape-up regimens, right? So scratch the chocolates. But books are a fabulously rich indulgence. Today, we'll preview titles that celebrate relationships, which can be so wonderful, so complex, and so much fun to get lost in. So turn on some romantic background music, and we'll turn on the love as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Jess Walter's Beautiful Ruins begins in 1962. On a sun-drenched Italian coastline, a young innkeeper looks out over the sea and spies a woman, a vision in white, approaching on a boat. He learns she's an actress, but one whose future is uncertain. And the story begins again today, half a world away, and years later, as an elderly Italian man arrives on a movie studio's back lot, searching for the mysterious woman he last saw at his hotel decades earlier. What unfolds is a dazzling roller coaster of a novel spanning 50 years and nearly as many lives. From the lavish set of Cleopatra to the shabby revelry of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, we are drawn into the tangled lives of a dozen unforgettable characters. Gloriously inventive, Beautiful Ruins is the story of flawed yet fascinating people. Eduardo Ballerini performs the book.
He'd recently come home from 4 years in bustling Florence, returning to the tiny backward village of his youth, imagining that he brought vital news of the world out there. A glittering era of shiny macchine, of televisions and telephones, of double martinis and women in slender pants, of the kind of world that had seemed to exist before only in the cinema. Porto Vergogna was a tight cluster of a dozen old whitewashed houses, an abandoned chapel, and the town's only commercial interest, the tiny hotel and cafe owned by Pasquale's family. All huddled like a herd of sleeping goats in a crease in the sheer cliffs. Behind the village, the rocks rose 600 feet to a wall of black striated mountains. Below it, the sea settled in a rocky, shrimp-curled cove from which the fishermen put in and out every day. Isolated by the cliffs behind and the sea in front, the village had never been accessible by car or cart, and so the streets, such as they were, consisted of a few narrow pathways between the houses, brick-lined roads skinnier than sidewalks, plunging alleys and rising staircases so narrow that unless one was standing in the Piazza San Pietro, the little town square, it was possible anywhere in the village to reach out and touch walls on either side. In this way, remote Porto Vergogna was not so different from the quaint cliffside towns of the Cinque Terre to the north, except that it was smaller, more remote, and not as picturesque. Yet, despite his neighbor's disdain, Pasquale had come to believe, as his father had, that Porto Vergogna could someday flourish like the rest of the Levante, the coastline south of Genoa that included the Cinque Terre, or even the larger tourist cities on the Ponente, Portofino, and the sophisticated Italian Riviera. The rare foreign tourists who boated or hiked into Porto Vergogna tended to be lost French or Swiss. But Pasquale held out hope that the 1960s would bring a flood of Americans, led by the bravissimo U.S. President John Kennedy and his wife Jacqueline. And yet, if his village had any chance of becoming the destinazione turistica primaria he dreamed of, Pasquale knew it would need to attract such vacationers, and to do that it would need, first of all, a beach. And so Pasquale stood half-submerged, holding a big rock beneath his chin as the red mahogany boat bobbed into his cove. His old friend Orenzio was piloting it for the wealthy vintner and hotelier Gualfredo, who ran the tourism south of Genoa, but whose fancy 10-meter sport boat rarely came to Porto Vergogna. Pasquale watched the boat settle in its chop and could think of nothing to do but call out, "Orenzio!" His friend was confused by the greeting. They had been friends since they were 12, but they were not yellers, he and Pasquale, more acknowledgers, lip-raisers, eyebrow-tippers. Orenzio nodded back grimly. He was serious when he had tourists in his boat, especially Americans. "They are serious people, Americans," Orenzio had explained to Pasquale once. "Even more suspicious than Germans. If you smile too much, Americans assume you're stealing from them." Today, Orenzio was especially dour-faced, shooting a glance toward the woman in the back of his boat, her long tan coat pulled tight around her thin waist, her floppy hat covering most of her face. Then the woman said something quietly to Orenzio, and it carried across the water. Gibberish, Pasquale thought at first, until he recognized it as English, American, in fact. "Pardon me, what is that man doing?"
That was Beautiful Ruins by Jess Walter. England, 1959. Laurel Nicholson is 16 years old. At a celebration at Green Acres, her family farm, she climbs into her treehouse for some moments alone. She spies a stranger approaching, observes her mother speaking to a man, and then she witnesses a crime. 50 years later, Laurel has been a successful actress living in London. She returns to Green Acres for her mother's 90th birthday, but she becomes overwhelmed by questions she's not thought about for decades. Laurel finally determines to find out the truth. What happened that summer day? Caroline Lee performs The Secret Keeper by Kate Morton, a book that explores longings and dreams, the lengths some people go to fulfill them, and the strange consequences they sometimes have.
Although they were still a way off, through some odd quirk of the wind current, Laurel could hear quite clearly the tune her mother was singing. It was a song she'd sung to each of them in turn, and the baby laughed with pleasure, shouting, "Ma! Ma!" though it sounded like "more, more," as Mum crept her fingers up his tummy to tickle his chin. Their focus on one another was so complete, their appearance together in the sun-drenched meadow so idyllic, that Laurel was torn between joy at having observed the private interaction and envy at being outside it. As her mother unlatched the gate and started for the house, Laurel realized with sinking spirit that she'd come for the cake knife herself. At every step, Laurel's opportunity for redemption receded further. She grew sulky, and her sulkiness stopped her from calling out or climbing down, rooting her instead to the treehouse floor. There she sat, stewing darkly in a strangely pleasant manner, as her mother reached and entered the house. One of the hula hoops fell silently to hit the ground, and Laurel took the action as a show of solidarity. She decided to stay where she was. Let them miss her a while longer. She'd get to the stream when she was good and ready. In the meantime, she was going to read the birthday party again and imagine a future far away from here, a life where she was beautiful and sophisticated, grown up and scab-free. The man, when he first appeared, was little more than a hazy smudge on the horizon, right down at the furthest reach of the driveway. Laurel was never sure, later, what it was that made her look up then. For one awful second, when she first noticed him walking towards the back of the farmhouse, Laurel thought it was Billy, arrived early and coming to fetch her. Only as his outline clarified and she realized he was dressed all wrong, dark trousers, shirt sleeves, and a black hat with an old-fashioned brim, did she let herself exhale. Curiosity arrived hot on the heels of relief. Visitors were rare at the farmhouse, those on foot rarer still, though there was a vague memory at the back of Laurel's mind as she watched the man come closer. An odd sense of déjà vu that she couldn't place, no matter how hard she tried. Laurel forgot that she was sulking, and with the luxury of concealment, surrendered herself to staring. She leaned her elbows on the windowsill, her chin on her hands. He wasn't bad-looking for an older man, and something in his posture suggested a confidence of purpose. Here was a man who didn't need to rush. Certainly, he was not someone she recognized, not one of her father's friends from the village, or any of the farmhands. There was always the possibility he was a lost traveler seeking directions, but the farmhouse was an unlikely choice, tucked away as it was so far from the road. Perhaps he was a gypsy, or a drifter, one of those men who chanced by occasionally, down on their luck, and grateful for whatever work Daddy had to give them. Or, Laurel thrilled at the terrible idea, he might be the man she'd read about in the local newspaper, the one the adults spoke of in nervous strains, who'd been disturbing picnickers and frightening women who walked alone along the hidden bend downriver. Laurel shivered, scaring herself briefly. And then she yawned. The man was no fiend. She could see his leather satchel now. He was a salesman, come to tell her mother about the newest encyclopedia set they couldn't live without. And so she looked away. Minutes passed, not many, and the next thing she heard was Barnaby's low growl at the base of the tree. Laurel scrambled to the window, peering over the sill to see the spaniel standing to attention in the middle of the brick path.
We've just heard The Secret Keeper by Kate Morton. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Kathy Marie Buchanan's The Painted Girls is set in Paris in the late 1800s. The three Van Gotham sisters find their lives upended following the death of their father. Without his wages, and with their alcoholic mother, eviction from their single boarding room seems imminent. With few options open to them, 14-year-old Marie and her younger sister Charlotte enter the Paris Opera. For 7 francs a week, the girls train to enter its famous ballet. Their older sister, the insolent 17-year-old Antoinette, finds herself launched into the orbit of Émile Zola and into the arms of a man who may be a murderer. Marie throws herself into dance, but that salary is not enough. she begins to model for Edouard Degas, where her image will be forever immortalized in his controversial sculpture, Little Dancer, aged 14. Antoinette, meanwhile, descends lower and lower. Eventually, she must choose between honest labor as a laundress or the more profitable avenues available in the Paris demi-monde. This riveted tale captures the time of profound artistic, cultural, and societal change. An ensemble cast narrates.
Monsieur Leblanc leans against the doorframe, his arms folded over a belly grown round on pork crackling. A button is missing from his waistcoat, pulled too tight for the threads to bear. Maman wrings her hands, laundress's hands, marked by chapped skin, raw knuckles. "But, Monsieur Leblanc," she says, "we just put my dead husband in the ground."
"It's been 2 weeks, Madame von Goethem. You said you needed 2 weeks."
No sooner had Papa taken his last breath upon this earth than, same as now, Monsieur Leblanc stood in the doorway of our lodging room demanding the 3 months' rent Papa had fallen behind in paying since getting sick. Maman drops to her knees, grasps the hem of Monsieur Leblanc's greatcoat.
"You cannot turn us out. My daughters, all 3 good girls, you would put them on the street?"
"Take pity," I say, joining Maman at his feet.
"Yes, pity," says Charlotte,
my younger sister, and I wince. She plays her part too well for a child not yet 8. Only Antoinette, the oldest of the 3 of us, remains silent, defiant, chin held high. But then she is never afraid. Charlotte grasps one of Monsieur Leblanc's hands in both her own, kisses it, rests her cheek against its back. He sighs heavily, and it seems tiny Charlotte, adored by the pork butcher, the watchmaker, the crockery dealer, has saved us from the street. Seeing his face shift to soft, Maman says, "Take my ring," and slips her wedding band from her finger. She presses it to her lips before placing it in Monsieur Leblanc's waiting hand. Then, with great drama, her palms fly to the spot on her chest, just over her heart. Not wanting him to see in my eyes what I know about Maman's feelings for Papa, I turn my face away. Whenever Papa mentioned he was a tailor, apprenticed to a master as a boy, Mama always said, "The only tailoring you ever done is stitching the overalls the men at the porcelain factory wear." Monsieur Leblanc closes his fingers around the ring.
2 weeks more," he says. "You'll pay up then."
Or a cart will haul off the sideboard handed down to Papa before he died. The table and 3 rickety chairs the lodger before us left behind, the mattresses stuffed with wool, each handful worth 5 sous to a pawnbroker. Our lodging room will be empty, only 4 walls, grimy and soot-laden, deprived of a lick of whitewash. And there will be a new lock on the door, and the concierge, old Madame Legas, fingering the key in her pocket, her gaze sorrowful on the curve of Charlotte's pretty cheek. Of the 3 of us, only Antoinette is old enough to remember nights in a dingy stairwell, days on the Boulevard Haussmann, palms held out, empty, the rustle of the silk skirts passing by. She told me once how it was that other time when Papa sold his sewing machine to pay for a tiny white gown with crocheted lace, a small white coffin with a painting of 2 cherubs blowing horns, a priest to say the mass. I am the namesake of a small dead child, Marie, or Marie the First, as I usually think of her. Before her 2nd birthday, she was rigid in her cradle, eyes fixed on what she could not see. And then I came, a gift, Mama said, to take her place.
We've just heard The Painted Girls by Kathy Marie Buchanan. Tracy Chevalier hails from Washington, D.C., but she's made England her home throughout her adulthood. Tracy received her B.A. in English from Oberlin College, Ohio, and her M.A. in creative writing from the University of East Anglia in Norwich, England. She lives in London with her English husband and son. Before turning to writing full-time, she was a reference book editor. She's written 7 novels. Her second novel, Girl with a Pearl Earring, sold 4 million copies worldwide and was made into a film starring Colin Firth and Scarlett Johansson. Today we'll speak with her about her new title, The Last Runaway. Welcome, Tracy. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Book Report.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Last Runaway is your first novel set in America in the 1850s. How did you select the Quakers and their participation in the Underground Railroad as your topic?
Well, when I was young, I went to a Quaker camp in Thurmont, Maryland, outside of Washington, about 70 miles west. And I grew up knowing about Quaker ideology and Quaker silence, and it really appealed to me, although I'm not a member of Quaker at the moment. I still go to meetings sometimes, and I had this feeling a few years ago more and more that the world has become a very noisy place. And one day I remember being on a street in Manhattan trying to talk to somebody on a cell phone, and I couldn't hear a thing. And everybody around me seemed to be able to do it no problem. And I thought, is it just me, or is this world too noisy? And it made me kind of run towards silence a bit. And the Quakers sit in silence for an hour every week at their form of church. And I like to do that, and I thought, wouldn't it be great to have a character who is quiet? And I thought, well, a Quaker would make sense. And in fact, when I had the idea for the book, I had just been to Oberlin College, which is my alma mater, and I happened to see Toni Morrison there unveiling a bench that is a memorial to slavery and the Underground Railroad that ran through Oberlin. And I put the two ideas together because I knew that Quakers had done a lot of work on the Underground Railroad. In fact, they were responsible, really, for the growth of abolitionism from about the 1830s onward. And I just thought it would be a great topic to write about.
Well, as a way to introduce your book, talk a little about your main characters, Honor Bright, Belle, Jack Haymaker, Donovan, my favorite, and Mrs. Reed.
Oh, everybody likes Donovan. You love to hate him and hate to love him.
He's a bad boy.
Yeah, he's a bad boy. My main character, Honor Bright, is a young English Quaker who emigrates to Ohio in 1850. She accompanies her sister, who is going to marry another Englishman who has emigrated. And for various circumstances, various reasons, Honor finds herself alone once she's in Ohio. And rather abandoned because she had such a terrible crossing across the Atlantic that she knows she can never go back. She was too seasick. So she's stuck in Ohio, and she ends up meeting a bunch of different characters who are a range of personalities. I think my favorite character in the book is a woman named Belle Mills, who is a milliner. She makes hats. And she takes Honor in for a couple of days until Honor finally finds her way to her Quaker community. And Belle is exactly what you wouldn't expect a milliner to look like. You know, you'd think a milliner would be quite pretty and feminine, and Belle is none of those things, although she makes hats. She's quite plain. She's very plain-speaking, quite tough, uses a gun well, and drinks a lot of whiskey. And she also helps runaway slaves on the Underground Railroad escape up towards Canada. And that is really the start of it. And then there's another other characters include the Haymaker family, Jack Haymaker, who Honor ends up with. There's also Donovan, who is a slave hunter. And all of these characters have their various good and bad characteristics. And I think one of the important things for me in the book was to make sure that everybody had shades of gray in them, not just black, not just white, but shades of gray.
Now, in your research, you shared that black Quakers were expected to sit in a Negro pew in meeting houses, and that really surprised me.
Yeah, it surprised me, too. Quakers, the ideology of Quakers is that is the belief that there is a piece of God, or what they might call the inner light or the inner spirit, in every person. And because of that, all people are equal and should be treated thus, which means that you would think Quakers would be opposed to slavery. So two things surprised me. One is I discovered that some Quakers did have slaves in the 18th century. Eventually, in 1776, they stopped. But the other thing that really surprised me was this idea of, quote-unquote, the Negro pew, which apparently there were some black Quakers, and members, black Quakers could go to meeting, but they were not allowed to sit, at least in some meetings, not allowed to sit with white Quakers. They had their own bench. And I was really amazed by that, the sort of casualness with which that sort of prejudice was played out in what was supposedly an equal place, an equal setting. And when I found it out, I thought, you know, in a way, it really helps the novel because, as I said before, I don't want any of the characters to be all good or all bad. And the danger of writing about Quakers is that they just sound too good to be true. And indeed they were. And so that makes for a much more nuanced exploration of the issues of slavery, emancipation. When do you have a principle? When do you stand up for your principles? And when do you hold back?
Your book also shared some very difficult choices made by those who opposed slavery. In a way, they really had their hands tied to be openly supportive. Talk a little about that.
Well, I set the book in 1850, and that was a very specific reason, is that this legislation came into effect in August or September of 1850 called the Fugitive Slave Act, or Fugitive Slave Law. And it was a law that said basically, runaway slaves, if anyone helped them, they could be fined or imprisoned. And that had already been the case. But what was added with this particular act was that not only could you be fined, but you also had to, if a slave hunter or the owner of the slave came after them, this is in a northern state, came after them, if they needed help and they asked you for help, you had to help them out. And that really got on people's nerves. It was sort of, in some ways, the beginning of a real awakening amongst the public. Not just abolitionists had been working for years, but I think the general public was incensed by the idea that somebody could demand of them, you have to help me. And if they didn't, they could be fined or imprisoned. And having this in the background, you know, when a runaway slave appears in your farmyard, what do you do? And that's literally what this book is about. And for Honor, who's from England, she's always opposed slavery on principle, but principles it was one thing to live in England where there wasn't any slavery, but suddenly when it's actually applied there, and she wants to help the slave who appears in the farmyard, her family is not so keen on it because they're afraid of being fined and they're afraid of being imprisoned. And there were huge fines, $1,000. I mean, you could ruin your farm if you had to pay that fine. And so the book explores this idea of it's not always so easy to put into practice the principles that you may hold.
Right. Actually, how much research did you do before you put pen to paper?
It's hard to quantify because I researched all the way through. In fact, the book is out, and I still feel like there are books that I should be reading and maps I should be looking at. I probably did 3 or 4 months of research before I started put pen to paper. But the thing is, the moment you put pen to paper, you realize, oh, I need to find out about this. I want, you know, one of my characters, an African-American woman named Mrs. Reed, who lives in Overland, who works on the Underground Railroad, her hat is trimmed with wildflowers. And I thought, oh, they're not the same wildflowers there as here. So I have to find out what would have been, you know, it's July or it's February. What could she have put on her hat? And it's funny little things like that. So you might start the general research and get a good idea of Ohio, the Underground Railroad, the Quakers, all of these notions. But then when you get to the specifics, you have to almost do the research all over again.
And do you actually go on location while you're writing a book to get the feel
yes,
of the place?
Of course. Mm-hmm. I've heard there are writers who write a book without ever visiting the place, but I am not one of those writers. I couldn't imagine not doing that. So I went over to Ohio several times. Luckily, you know, I went to Oberlin College as an English major in the 80s, and I still have friends there. Some of my old professors are now my friends, which is wonderful. And I go and stayed with them, and I drove around the back roads. I got out and sniffed the air. I tried to describe it. I looked at the sunshine. I took photos. I looked at all those wildflowers. I walked through virgin forests. I visited an Amish farm to see how a 19th century style farm would be run. And all of that really goes into the pot.
Hmm. So are you already at work on a new project?
Yes, I'm not as far into it as I'd like to be, but I do have a new project in mind. I've been toying with the idea of not writing a purely historical novel, and I think that scared me. But all I'm going to say is that the book is going to involve trees, and it will probably take place in a couple of different countries.
Readers, The Last Runaway is a great historical novel. I think you'll love it. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Alrighty, bye.
Okay, bye.
And now let's hear a sampling of Tracy Chevalier's The Last Runaway, narrated by Kate Redding.
Honor, however, had gripped the side of the boat while her brothers rowed, and tried not to appear alarmed at the rocking and the curious and unpleasant sensation of no longer having stable footing. She had watched her mother walking up and down the beach in her dark dress and white bonnet, waiting for her children to come back safely. Honor avoided going out in a boat again. She had heard stories of bad crossings, but hoped she would cope with such a thing as she did any other hardship, with steady patience. But she did not have sea legs. That was what the sailors said. Perhaps she should have realized this from her encounter with water under her feet in the rowboat. After leaving Bristol, she stood on deck with Grace and others, watching the Somerset and North Devon coast unfold alongside them. For the other passengers, the unsteadiness was an amusing novelty, but Honor grew more and more unsettled, responding to the ship's movement with a wrinkled brow, tightening shoulders, and a heaviness deep in her gut, as if she had swallowed an iron-pound weight. She held out as long as she could, but as the adventurer was passing Lundy Island, Honor's stomach finally convulsed and she vomited onto the deck. A passing sailor laughed. "Sick, and we're barely out of Bristol Channel," he crowed. "Wait till we reach the ocean. Then you'll know sickness." When they reached the Atlantic and the ship began its long roll up and down the swell of the waves, she continued to be sick. Only now Grace was ill, too, as well as many of the other passengers, though only for a time until they got used to the new rhythm of the boat. Honor never got used to it. The nausea did not leave her for the whole month-long voyage. When not seasick herself, Grace nursed Honor, rinsing her sheets, emptying the basin, bringing broth and hard sea biscuit, reading to her from the Bible, or the few books they had brought, Mansfield Park, the old curiosity shop, Martin Chuzzlewit. To distract Honor, she chattered on about America, trying to get her to think about what lay ahead, rather than the grimness of the present moment. "What would thee rather see, a bear or a wolf?" she asked, then answered her own question. "A bear, I think, for wolves are like overgrown dogs, but a bear is only like itself. What would thee rather travel on, a steamboat or a train?" Honor groaned at the thought of another boat. "Yes, a train," Grace agreed. "I wish there were a train we could take from New York to Ohio. There will be one day." "Oh, Honor, imagine, soon we will be in New York." Honor grimaced, wishing that she too could see this move as the great adventure Grace clearly did. Her sister had always been the restless bright, the one most ready to accompany their father when he had to travel to Bristol or Portsmouth or London. She had even agreed to marry an older, duller man because of the promise he held out of a life away from Bridport. Grace had known the Coxes a family of five brothers, since they had moved from Exeter several years before to open a draper's shop. But she only showed interest in Adam when he decided to emigrate to Ohio. A brother, Matthew, had already gone there, but had become infirm, and his wife had written to ask a spare brother to come and help with the business. Once Adam had moved to America, he and Grace corresponded regularly, and with gentle hints, she led him to ask her to join him in Ohio as his wife, where they would run the shop with Matthew and Abigail. The Brights were surprised by Grace's choice. Honor had thought she would marry someone livelier, but Grace was so thrilled by the prospect of living in America that she did not seem to mind her prospective husband's reserve.
We've just heard The Last Runaway by Tracy Chevalier. Despite the tumor-shrinking medical miracle that bought her a few additional years, Hazel has never been anything but terminal. But when the gorgeous Augustus Waters suddenly appears at Cancer Kids Support Group, Hazel's story is about to be completely rewritten. So the Book Report is pleased to bring you John Green's wildly popular The Fault in Our Stars, an exploration of the brilliantly funny and sometimes tragic business of being alive and in love. Kate Rudd narrates.
Once we got around the circle, Patrick always asked if anyone wanted to share. And then began the circle jerk of support. Everyone talking about fighting and battling and winning and shrinking and scanning. To be fair to Patrick, he let us talk about dying, too. But most of them weren't dying. Most would live into adulthood, as Patrick had. Which meant there was quite a lot of competitiveness about it, with everybody wanting to beat not only cancer itself, but also the other people in the room. The only redeeming facet of support group was this kid named Isaac, a long-faced, skinny guy with straight blonde hair swept over one eye. And his eyes were the problem. He had some fantastically improbable eye cancer. One eye had been cut out when he was a kid, and now he wore the kind of thick glasses that made his eyes, both the real one and the glass one, preternaturally huge. Like his whole head was basically just this fake eye and this real eye staring at you. From what I could gather on the rare occasions when Isaac shared with the group, a recurrence had placed his remaining eye in mortal peril. Isaac and I communicated almost exclusively through sighs. Each time someone discussed anti-cancer diets or snorting ground-up shark fin or whatever, he'd glance over at me and sigh ever so slightly. I'd shake my head microscopically and exhale in response. So support group blew, and after a few weeks, I grew to be rather kicking and screaming about the whole affair. In fact, on the Wednesday, I made the acquaintance of Augustus Waters. I tried my level best to get out of support group while sitting on the couch with my mom in the third leg of a 12-hour marathon of the previous season's America's Next Top Model, which admittedly I had already seen, but still. Me. I refused to attend support group. Mom. One of the symptoms of depression is disinterest in activities. Me. Please just let me watch America's Next Top Model. It's an activity. Mom. Television is a passivity. Me. Ugh, Mom, please. Mom. Hazel, you're a teenager. You're not a little kid anymore. You need to make friends, get out of the house, and live your life. Me. If you want me to be a teenager, don't send me to support group. Buy me a fake ID so I can go to clubs, drink vodka, and take pot. Mom. You don't take pot, for starters. Me. See? That's the kind of thing I'd know if you got me a fake ID. Mom. You're going to support group. Me. Mom. Hazel, you deserve a life. That shut me up. Although I failed to see how attendance at support group met the definition of life. Still, I agreed to go. After negotiating the right to record the 1.5 episodes of ANTM I'd be missing. I went to support group for the same reason that I'd once allowed nurses with a mere 18 months of graduate education to poison me with exotically named chemicals. Mom pulled into the circular driveway behind the church at 4:56. I pretended to fiddle with my oxygen tank for a second just to kill time. "Do you want me to carry it in for you?" "No, it's fine," I said. The cylindrical green tank only weighed a few pounds, and I had this little steel cart to wheel it around behind me. It delivered 2 liters of oxygen to me each minute through a cannula, a transparent tube that split just beneath my neck, wrapped behind my ears, and then reunited in my nostrils. The contraption was necessary because my lungs sucked at being lungs. "I love you," she said as I got out. "You too, Mom. See you at 6. Make friends," she said through the rolled-down window as I walked away.
We've just heard The Fault in Our Stars by John Green. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Attenberg is the author of the wildly acclaimed The Middlesteins, and also the novels The Kept Man and The Melting Season. Jamie's written about sex, technology, design, graphic novels, books, TV, and urban life for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Esquire.com, and many more. She's contributed to numerous anthologies and wrote Instant Love, a collection of stories. She lives in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm thrilled to be speaking with her today. Welcome, Jamie. Thanks so much for joining us on The Book Report.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Introduce us to the Middlesteins by telling listeners a few sentences about each of the main characters.
Well, Edie Middlestein is the matriarch of the family that lives in the suburbs of Chicago, and she is killing herself with food. Richard Middlestein is her husband, and they're both in their 60s, so I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying that he leaves her. He leaves her in the second chapter of the book, so I think it's okay to say that. And then there's Benny, their son, who is an accountant, and Robin is their daughter, and she's a school teacher. And everyone in the family is just sort of contending with Edie refusing to take care of herself.
Well, I've seen photos of you, and you're not overweight at all. How did you come to write this book?
Not that hard to understand somebody who has a complicated relationship with food. I sort of feel like every woman I know, at least, has a complicated relationship with food on one end of the spectrum or the other. I was just I was interested in exploring my relationship with it. Initially, the book was really about how you deal with somebody who doesn't want to take care of themselves, though. That was sort of the biggest nut of the book.
And how do all of us as children of immigrants get over this food is love curse?
I feel like my book is definitely not prescriptive in any way. I have no solutions to any of this. Certainly as I've been touring and talking to people, I've been hearing more and more stories where, you know, people are overweight or they don't, or they are trying to work through things. And I never really have an answer. I think the intention of the book was really, and the intention of every book that I write is really to start a conversation about something. And I think that's kind of the first step. I spoke to a woman the other night who I was doing a book club, and she was overweight and was really struggling with it and talking about the challenges that she was facing. And I said, "You're already in a better place than Edie, because Edie doesn't even want to talk about it." So it's good to, you know, at least to open up, I think. And then I don't know how to help people. I just sort of know how to talk about things, you know?
Yeah. Well, Richard, as you said, Edie's husband of more than 30 years, files for divorce because he can't stand to watch his wife eating herself to death. At first, I really hated him, and then towards the end of the book, not so much. How do you feel about him?
You know, with all the characters, there's unlikable things about them and likable things about them. With Richard, I really had to write my way into liking him. All of them, really, I had to do that. But he was a bit of a challenge because I wanted to understand how somebody could leave somebody who was sick. But I really sort of was fond of him by the end. I mean, he really just wanted love. It wasn't kind of about abandoning this person. I think their relationship had been dead for a long time. It was more about, I believe that the people are at least entitled to try for love in this life. So I think he didn't want to give up
in the same way that she had.
Well, I really enjoyed how you wrote the relationship of Edie's daughter, Robin, with her neighbor, Daniel. Tell us more about that.
You know, no one ever really asks about that relationship. That's interesting. Everyone just sort of, I think people have kind of a weird, tend to like Robin, but I thought it was very sweet. I thought they were, they became friends and then they sort of fall in love. And I thought that they, he was there for her as best as he could be there for her. And I think that he's kind of a pushover, but he's also got a little bit of a backbone too.
Yeah, I liked him enormously, actually. And then there's Rachel, Edie's skinny daughter-in-law. She is obsessed with weight and food. And I know a lot of girls like her, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, she's like the opposite end of the spectrum, really, from Edie. She was actually, I think, the character I most had trouble with, where I had to write my way into liking her. But I think she's really about family and keeping the family intact. I mean, she's got an obsession in the same way that Edie has an obsession, but she also has a very clear vision of what she wants from life, which I really admire in someone.
Okay, although she might have seemed a little manic, especially, you know, the way that she served dinner to the family as Edie's weight kind of ballooned, her family had to eat more and more raw vegetables, it seemed.
I feel like by the end of the book, she's sort of starting to loosen up a little bit.
Okay.
That was my intention anyway, just a hint of her kind of loosening up. I mean, she's got, you know, adolescent kids coming, they're going to bring their own kind of storm, so she's going to have to loosen up.
Yeah, that's true. All right, this was kind of a hard question for me. Edie's kids try so hard to put their mother on the straight and narrow. I know that I tried to stop my own father from smoking. I think many of us have had these similar gut-wrenching experiences. Did you maybe write some of this from your own experience?
My parents are happily married and are disciplined in their own way of, you know, they're pretty aware of keeping, going to the gym and eating right and that kind of thing. So it was not my, you know, if anything, it was my own experience, like me keeping my own act together more than anything else. So if I'm, you know, if the conversation and the struggle seems real in any way, it might have been me having that discussion with myself, me putting myself into it. But my parents, I mean, I just did a bunch of readings and Chicago, which is where I'm originally from, and my parents came to all the readings, and I made sure to point out that they were not morbidly obese. They're happily married. They're still together. They still love each other. So, you know, it's fiction. It's a novel. It's invented. So there's always elements, you know, every author puts elements of them, of their own life in it, even if it becomes transformed into something else. But certainly by the end of the book, these characters were all on their own unique creation.
You know, at the end of the book, I thought that Edie maybe had a lot to stay alive for. She had this new love with Kenneth Song, the owner of the Chinese restaurant, and perhaps her relationship with her granddaughter especially. But
you're giving away the plot.
I'm sorry.
You're giving away everything.
Okay, but she seems sort of hell-bent on disaster. I mean, you want to talk about that at all?
Hell-bent on disaster. I mean, I just think she's in denial about a lot of things, and she was possibly, you know, I think it's interesting that you said that these kids fought so hard for their, you know, to take care of their mother, because I don't actually think that they really did fight that hard to take care of their mother until the very end of the book. I think a lot of things sort of got, like, fell through the cracks because people don't want to actually deal with problems within their family until it is too late. But they did try. They just didn't, you know, and also, like, they don't necessarily know how to. I mean, I don't think people want to deal with stuff until it's too late. I think that's maybe a bigger message of the book.
All right. Well, what's next for you?
I am writing a new book this year that's a historical novel, which I'm not really so fascinated with historical novels, but I became fascinated with this real-life historical figure who ran a movie theater on the Bowery in New York from 1920s to the 1940s. And she was kind of this boozy, body, complicated, flawed woman, but she also helped all the homeless men on the Bowery every night for decades. and gave them money and made sure they didn't die in the cold and that kind of thing. So I just sort of became really fascinated with her and decided I wanted to write about her.
All right. Well, is there a working title for that book?
Yeah, Saint Maisie.
Thank you for a wonderful book that I know all my friends are talking about and really, really loved. Thank you.
That's awesome.
All righty.
Thanks, Elaine.
All righty.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
And now let's hear a sample of Jamie Attenberg's The Middlesteins, narrated by actress Molly Ringwald.
Robin's mother, Edie, was having another surgery in a week. Same procedure, different leg. Everyone kept saying, "At least we know what to expect." Robin and her downstairs neighbor, Daniel, were toasting the leg at the bar across the street from their apartment building. It was cold out, January in Chicago. Robin had worn 5 layers just to walk across the street. Daniel was already drunk by the time she got there. Her mother was getting cut open twice in 1 year. Cheers. The bar was a no-name, no-shame, no-nothing kind of place. Robin had a hard time giving directions to it. There was a fluorescent old-style sign in the sole window, but no number on the front door. Between 242 and 246 is what she would say, although for some reason that confused people. But not Daniel. He knew the way. "Here's to number 2, said Daniel. He raised his glass. He was drinking the brown stuff. Usually he drank the yellow stuff or the amber stuff, but it was winter. "Is it the right or the left leg?" "You know, I can't even remember. I think I've blocked it out. Isn't that terrible? Am I a terrible person?" All of it had been a surprise, though it shouldn't have been. Her mother refused to eat properly or exercise, and in the last decade she had grown obese. 2 years ago, she had been diagnosed with diabetes. It was an advanced case. The diabetes, combined with a disastrous gene pool, had led to an arterial disease in her legs. What had started out as tingling had turned to constant pain. Robin had seen her mother's legs in the hospital after the first surgery and had gagged at their blue tinge. How had her mother not noticed? Or her father? How had this slipped through the cracks? The doctor had inserted a small metal tube, a stent, into her leg so that the blood could flow properly. Robin wondered, where did the blood go if it did not flow? Originally, the doctor had wanted to do a bypass, an idea that threatened everyone. He still did, according to Robin's brother, Benny. "This could get serious fast," he had told her. "We've been warned." But Edie had negotiated with the doctor. She promised to behave herself. She promised to do the work to get herself right. 35 years as a lawyer, she knew how to put up a fight. 6 months later, Edie had changed nothing in her life, taken not one step to help herself, and here they all were again. "It's not that I don't care," said Robin. "It's just that I don't want to know." She knew too much already. This was real life kicking her in the face, and she wanted nothing to do with it. Last weekend, she had gone home to check on the madness, back to the suburb where she had grown up and then evacuated 13 years earlier, hoping never to return, but finding herself there all too much these days. Her mother had picked her up in front of the train station and then driven around the corner and parked in front of a movie theater. It was late afternoon. There had been a half day at the school where Robin taught. She'd had fantasies about what she would do with that free afternoon. A long run along the lake during the warmest part of the day, or an early bender with Daniel, but it was not to be. Senior citizens walked out of the matinee as if in slow motion. A few stay-at-home moms dragged their toddlers toward the parking lot across the street. Robin almost hurled herself out of the car after them. "Take me with you." "There's something I need to tell you before we go home," her mother had said. Heavy breath, hulking beneath her fur coat, no flesh visible except for her putty-colored face, her drooping chin, her thick ringed neck. "Your father has left me. He's had enough." "This is a joke," said Robin. "This is for real," said her mother. "He's flown the coop and he's not coming back."
That was The Middlesteins by Jamie Attenberg. Best-selling writing duo Janet Ivanovich and Dorian Kelly team up in the love story, The Husband List. Carolyn Maxwell would like nothing more than to join her brother Eddie and his friend Jack Culhane on their adventures. While Jack and Eddie are off seeing the world and building careers, Caroline is stuck at home, frightening off the men her mother hopes will ask for her hand in marriage. When her mother sets her sights on the questionable Lord Bremerton as a possible suitor, Caroline becomes disheartened. She longs for adventure, passion, and most of all, Jack Culhane, the unconventional Irish-American bachelor with new money and no title, completely unacceptable in the eyes of Caroline's mother. Set in New York in 1894, The Husband List is a Gilded Age romantic mystery. It evokes memories of the lavish lifestyles and social expectations of the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers, a time when new American money married old world social prestige. Lorelei King brilliantly performs the work.
"Absolutely, you have gained since your last fitting," the seamstress said, "and more than a little."
Caroline answered with a vague smile. It would never do to confess that she'd begun midnight kitchen forays to ease her tight nerves.
"Caroline, have you varied from our agreed-upon menu?" her mother asked.
Alarm had made her dark brows arch closer to her perfectly coiffed hair with its beginning threads of silver. There had been no agreement. There hadn't even been negotiations, just no outright objection from Caroline. She decided long ago that working around her mother was more diplomatic than upsetting her. Easier, too. And since her mother's eating edict had made Caroline 50% a spectator at family meals, she felt she deserved a fat slice of chocolate cake whenever she wished. It wasn't noon yet, and her mouth watered at the thought of tonight's pilfered treat. Actually, not so very pilfered, since cook had caught on to the scheme and now left cake waiting for her. Mama pursed her lips and scrutinized Caroline more closely.
"You must have been straying. You are looking plumper in the face when Amelia and Helen are still as slim as can be."
At 16, her twin sisters didn't yet have the avoidance skills Caroline possessed at 21, or the same ability to hold their tongues under their mother's inquisition techniques. They always confessed. Caroline kept her silence. Mama narrowed her eyes. Caroline widened hers. Mama cleared her throat, giving warning of a lecture to come. Caroline did her best to exude an aura of innocence as strong as her mother's favored gardenia perfume. It must have worked, because Mama heaved a resigned sigh.
"Stand taller," she ordered, "shoulders back and chin up."
Caroline complied, though the gown would be no looser around her waist for the effort. Tonight's cake would have to be her last for a while. It wasn't as though she could eat her way to freedom. American heiresses were as popular with unmarried and underfunded English noblemen as chocolate cake was with Caroline.
"If you are to wear a coronet, you must look as though you were born to it," Mama said. That and, "You are this family's crown jewel," were two of her mother's favorite things to say.
Caroline found both statements as uncomfortable as the corset currently mashing her innards. Mama had been about to issue another proclamation, probably about crown jewels, but was distracted by a one-person stampede down the mahogany parquet hallway. Annie, Caroline's new personal maid, appeared. Breathless, she took an instant to compose herself. It was hopeless. During her dash, her red curls had sprung free from their tight bun and were now nearly at right angles from the white cap atop her head.
"Mrs. Maxwell, ma'am, O'Brien has asked me to tell you that Mrs. Longhorn is calling," Annie said.
She thrust out a calling card. She did not, however, have the silver tray that the butler used, so Caroline's mother pretended not to see it.
We've just heard The Husband List by Janet Ivanovich and Dorian Kelly. Readers, I hope your Valentine's Day is filled with romance and, like every good book, wonderful twists and turns. For more lovely suggestions, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.